Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you for tuning in. Hello, my name is Ben Bullen, and I am, I don't know if I'm addicted, but I'm going through a real serious shopping online phase. What about you guys?
You know, can you hear my squeaky chair, you guys?
Yes.
Can totally hear it.
Do you think they ship me a chair? Is that a thing you can order online, or is that too big? Well, I have to put it together myself because I'm not down with that. What do you think?
You can order them online.
I think assembly would be required. And I also think, yes, they probably would not ship it at this point.
I can do some assembly. I can't. I mean, you know, if you could send me, I'll put on the wheels, but I don't want to like have to put the back on the chair. You know what I mean? I need a nice middle ground level of assembly.
I love building furniture, Noel. That's you. You're Noel Brown.
That's me. That's me.
So if you ever have furniture you want built and you have some kid or something, I will totally do it. That stuff's fun for me. It's like Legos.
It is true. It is like Legos. I don't mind building like an IKEA thing. I got an IKEA bed with like the drawers underneath, and those drawers were a real pain in the butt to get in place, but really glad I did it. I very much like my IKEA schwarn. but no, I've been doing a ton of online shopping, Ben. It's sort of an endorphin rush, kind of. I think we're like, you know, giving ourselves these brain chemical rewards by shopping online because it's just that instant gratification, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. I don't know about you, super producer Casey Pegram. Have you been ordering stuff online as well?
I've actually just stuck mostly to like groceries and, you know, the occasional takeout order. Not too much in the way of like buying stuff. I usually buy way more than I have been buying recently, but it is nice to have at least like one or two things that are pending you can kind of look forward to. It sort of differentiates the days a little bit when you get something in the mail. So a little bit, but not as much as it sounds like you guys are.
Wait. So you're ordering things online to help you remember what day it is?
Not so much to remember the day, but it's like if it's coming on Friday and it's Monday, it's like, ooh, well, Friday I'm going to get a thing. And that will sort of break up the monotony, the Groundhog Day-ness of, you know, every other day.
Of quarantines. Yeah, just to mock the passage of time, like a prisoner making a hash mark on the wall every day or something. I made a really weird online order today, just a very crazy grab bag. I ordered some LED wall strip lights for my daughter's room, a new shower curtain, kind of an artsy shower curtain. I wanted to jazz up my bathroom a little bit, and a liner, and I ordered a new toilet seat because mine is beyond repair. It's beyond help. You can't just, the level of grime on it is not coming off with a scrub anymore. So I want to just get a little refresh for the old there bathroom during these lock-in days.
Yeah, invest in yourself. I like that. Let's see. I've ordered guitar strings, Raspberry Pi homebrew kind of emulator thing, a book that I love called Around the World in 80 Trees or something like that. And then I'm thinking of like the weirdest stuff I've ordered, magnetic strips for various non-sketchy reasons, stuff like that. We should ask folks, you listening along at home, what are some of the weird things you've been ordering online? And what's the weirdest thing you've ever ordered in the past? Also, maybe why are we asking about online ordering? There's a reason.
It is, in fact, a sequitur. It's not a non-sequitur. Because, you know, we take for granted how with a click of a mouse, we can literally get everything from magnetic strips to guitar strings to toilet seats. But back in the day, this was a revolutionary idea. And, of course, there was no such thing as the internet. So it had to use this thing we used to use called paper, where you read, like, words that were printed on it, accompanied by vibrant illustrations that sort of created this kind of culture of the American dream and this aspirational notion of like, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and all that, having to have the things that were depicted in the pages of the Sears catalog.
Ah, yes, there we have it, the Sears catalog. Now, longtime listeners, fellow Ridiculous historians, you may remember earlier when the three of us dove into the strange story of our office building, which was once itself a Sears. Sears played a huge role in American culture. And I like the point you made, Noel, about the American dream aspect. People are kind of, they're buying pants or even in some cases, true story, houses, but really they're sort of purchasing a share of this ideal, you know, and Sears and its catalog changed the world. It's the predecessor of online ordering. And we can only imagine, without ourselves being neurologists, that when people ordered stuff from a Sears catalog, they also got that same rush of feel-good chemicals. And it became like this bedrock of American commerce. You know, it's weird because we talked about this in our previous episode. These days, a lot of us think of Sears as kind of like a cautionary tale about the woes of brick and mortar stores and retail in general, right? It filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and it's often now kind of portrayed as like this capitalist wasteland or something. You know, you walk into a Sears and it's abandoned. But like you said, Noel, at one time, this publication, the Sears catalog, was like, might as well have been a best-selling book.
Yeah, it's true. New York Times has a fabulous article about the history of Sears leading up to this Chapter 11 bankruptcy you mentioned, and makes a really good point of how many not only brands it was responsible for launching and elevating, ones that have far outlasted the Sears brand in terms of, you know, still being kind of relevant, but also authors and artists creating this platform where, you know, these creatives were able to thrive, and a medium where their work was reaching, you know, millions and millions of people, because the Sears catalog was a must-have item. Everyone wanted it. Even if you couldn't afford the things that were in it, you had the catalog. It was sort of like, you know, browsing, window shopping, you know, from your home in rural America. We talked about that in the Sears catalog episode about how popular it was in rural America, even if folks weren't buying the stuff inside of them. But folks like Edgar Rice Burroughs, who wrote the Tarzan books, was a copywriter. And Lauren Bacall was a model for the Sears catalog. And the list goes on. I always think of some of the images, the kind of illustrative sort of Norman Rockwell-esque kind of images of families and stuff. And that's really what sold a lot of Americans on this notion of what the American dream really looked like. And it wasn't limited to just this kind of aspirational window shopping. Turns out it actually played a pretty interesting part in spycraft and the activities of the CIA. And this story begins with a man by the name of John Wyant.
Yes, the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, named in sincerity, not satire, we should note. This is really fascinating because we said Sears went global, but maybe not in the way most people might assume. John Wyant was an intelligence agent, and he was deep in the game. He was deep in the spy game. And according to him, the Sears catalog was a, quote, almost obligatory thing to have with you. Because, you see, they ran into a pickle in Vietnam. They were conducting reconnaissance efforts during the Vietnam War, and they wanted insiders, they wanted natives, locals, to help gather information, especially along the border with Laos. John arrived in the area in 1966, right, in central Vietnam. And at this time, American involvement in the war is starting to escalate. This is just a year after the U.S. had deployed, 200,000 Marines to the country and started bombing the north part of the country. And so John takes over this small operation where Vietnam agents are bringing in, insider info about the activities of the Viet Cong.
Yeah, he was stationed in a place called Hue, I guess a village or a city, really. It was in central Vietnam, and it was a pretty wealthy place. It was lots of palaces there, and it was a stronghold for the American war effort there in Vietnam, specifically the intelligence side of things. And they had, the U.S. had deployed 200,000 Marines and were bombing northern Vietnam. He was in charge of kind of maintaining this relationship between the border of Vietnam and Cambodia. And he got to Hue in September of 1966. And he became kind of the handler of the handlers, of the folks who were getting information from villagers, from locals, about the Viet Cong and their movements and their activities. And this was dangerous work. I mean, these folks were essentially, what do you call them? Snitches, I guess. And you know what happens with snitches. They end up in stitches. And so this was very, very dangerous for these folks to be doing this work in these North Vietnamese secret zones, which were along the border with Laos. And a lot of these folks that were signing up for this kind of dangerous work certainly weren't going to do it for free. They were agrarian types. They were farmers. They were hand-making charcoal, for example, or farming and gathering materials to make furniture, you know, like hand-make furniture and crafts like rattan, which is, the stem of a palm tree of some kind.
Yep.
Yeah. So they were a kind of a barter-based system. The currency, which was known as the piaster, which I had never heard before, which was the national currency, wasn't really something that entered into their economic activities at all. They would trade with other agrarian workers. And so why would it be any different when they wanted to get paid by the CIA for doing these covert ops?
Right. These folks are not working for free. You know, there are a couple of different motivations for a spy, right, or for an asset. One motivation would be blackmail or extortion, right? Another motivation would be idealism, help us overthrow the government that you hate. And then, of course, a third motivation will be good old self-interest. Let me have money. Let me have power. Let me have stuff. And John ran into a problem because they needed to figure out a way to pay these spies, these assets. It's similar to the Pepsi deal with the USSR. You know, they couldn't get the currency to work. So the weirdest thing happened. The CIA and these other intelligence officers, you know, they do things any foreign visitor would do. They buy meals, they go to hotels, they rent cars, and they'll also foot the bill for people who are working under their purview. But these folks that were in these secret zones that Wyant was trying to work with, they were in a barter system. You know, they didn't really want a huge stack of cash. And it the onus of figuring out what these people want fell onto the agents. The farmers, the agrarian people that they're speaking with barely use money. They rarely use it. You know, they trade what they've created with things that other people create, right? And they notice that the agents or the assets they're trying to work with don't really want to get paid in the local currency, piasters. And they don't want to get paid because local authorities, local district chiefs, are putting a 33% tax on their income. And the tax that people were paying was disincentivizing these agents. They were doing less work. And then there was also like, why should I put in an effort when I'm only getting 2/3 of what you guys said you were going to pay me? And then one of Wyant's best handlers, according to an article he wrote about this event in Studies in Intelligence, one of his best agents had an unusual idea. He said, you know what? Instead of giving this one of my assets a local currency that they're going to be taxed on, let me get him this slick canvas hat. And the guy loved it. He loved it more than money.
Exactly. And let's not forget, that's a pretty practical thing. It's hot there. You know, it would protect them from getting the sun beaten down on them or whatever. And this was an entirely new idea. They'd done things like pay operatives with like bags of rice and other kinds of things that were just practical they could use. But it's when they start getting into the kind of that Norman Rockwell American aspirational idealism that the Sears catalog represented, that things start to get a little interesting, right? He gets this idea of, what if we kind of created a system of currency based on items found in the Sears catalog, like tiers of things? So for like a 20-day, you know, recon mission, you can get, it's like prizes at Chuck E. Cheese, you know, like with tickets. Like if you like spend this many tickets, you can get, you know, a blow pop. And if you spend, if you get a million tickets, you can get that, you know, Xbox or whatever. But this was all stuff in the Sears catalog. And largely, it was he picked out these items that he thought would work, but instructed his agents to let the operatives browse the catalog themselves. And the stuff that ended up appealing to them is pretty funny and interesting.
Yeah, I agree. And this also reminded me of Boy Scouts, because I spent a lot of summers selling popcorn. That is the far inferior food that Boy Scouts sell. It'll never touch the Girl Scout cookie industry. But when you would sell popcorn, you would get rewarded in these different tiers of stuff, you know? So it's a very good motivator. And I'm not knocking the popcorn. I'm just saying the cookies are awesome and objectively better. Anyway, you're right. It's a brilliant move. And Wyant gets messages back from the field just like as soon as 3 days later. He's hearing that this Sears concept is a fantastic success. And as a matter of fact, the only thing they change are the recommended products, because the stuff Wyant thought people would like was not exactly what they ended up wanting. When the assets browse the catalogs, they would start requesting, oddly enough, boys' clothing. Like, for instance, one person asked for 6 boy size red velvet blazers, that were blazer vests with brass buttons. And each of those 6 vests, which sound pretty snazzy and pretty loud, would be payment for a 20-day mission. They also asked for, I think, stamped leather cowboy belts.
So funny. And to me, immediately the thought that crossed my mind was, aren't they going to be suspicious as hell looking to, like, you know, the folks they're trying to hide from if they're all of a sudden just strutting around in like red velvet blazers? You can't get those in Laos, you know, certainly not during wartime. And that did end up being a thing that was mentioned. Didn't get too deep into that in the research. But yeah, it was certainly a byproduct of this that could have put these folks in danger. But yeah, things like, you know, denim jackets, a lot of it seemed like kind of weird cowboy garb and the kind of stuff that like bellhops would wear. It was very interesting. But it definitely was a success, and it didn't last super long. I think it petered out in around 1967, but it was largely because it was just too dangerous in general for agents to even be doing anything, because all these bombing raids were happening much more frequently, and it would be difficult to even get the shipments there.
Yeah, add to that the fact that the Marines began creating their own intelligence network. So eventually it was, you know, it was a question of redundancy, right? And the Sears system was short-lived, but it was very successful. Our favorite, one of our favorite items that they ordered during this time was a large bra. Wyant says that this bra was not ordered to be used as clothing, though. Instead, the assets took it and they stuck the bra on this bamboo pole, and they used it to harvest breadfruit from the trees. So they kind of made, you know, like those old reach and grab pincher things.
Totally. Yeah.
They kind of made something like that. And to me, that's cool. That speaks to the MacGyverness of the whole situation.
Oh, 100%. I initially pictured them using it as like a wind sock, you know, to like see which way the wind was blowing. A lot of these little more deeper cut uses come from a great article in Atlas Obscura called "The American Government's Sears for Spying Payment Plan." Wyant told the New York Times, quote, "I thought it was extraordinarily clever at the time," but then he acknowledged that it did pose some security risks in hostile zones if you got these agrarian folks used to dressing a certain way, all of a sudden rocking cowboy boots and denim jackets.
Agreed. And add to this the fact that if we think about it from a spycraft angle, if all of those guys are wearing the same snazzy red brass buttoned vest, then it starts to look very much like a uniform, which is not a good look in this situation.
Absolutely not.
We felt one more thing to add that might, I don't know. I think it's just something to think about as everybody is still going through the lockdown, which is that the Sears catalog had one other use that was pretty common back in the day, but was not, you know, officially condoned by Sears Roebuck themselves. And it's this. Apparently, Sears catalog makes for great toilet paper.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, not like something to do with the quality of the paper that it was printed on more than the fact that there'd be a new one that would come out every month and you'd have the old one. So you could just tear the pages out and put it in a little bin, you know, in your outhouse or whatever. And then there you go. You don't have to spend money on, I don't know, what was the toilet paper market like back then? I mean, obviously, I don't know. What's the history of mass-produced toilet paper?
That's a great idea.
You hear about things like corn cobs, which is, I don't understand. I guess because it's textured, maybe. Okay, we're getting a little, I don't want to get too gross here. I guess, you know, I'm disgusting myself even thinking about it. Again, let's just picture what the function of using a corn cob would be. And apparently sometimes they were tied to the outhouse with a string, implying that they were supposed to be reused. So I would say that the Sears catalog page is definitely a good alternative to that. But do remind me, and I'll do the same to you, Ben. I think we should look into the history of mass-produced toilet tissue.
Yeah, it's one of the it's one of those industries that hasn't left the United States, which is why we're not actually going to run out of toilet paper as a nation. The weirdest thing here about the Sears Roebuck catalog and its, dare I say, commodious use for households across America was that people actually objected to the quality of the catalog improving. Because back in the day, it was black and white paper, but when they started printing color pictures, they had to use a different kind of paper stock, and they got like hate mail about it.
Oh yeah, that'll chafe your you know, your area. Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be super comfortable using the newsprint, but the newsprint is a softer paper, and the glossy stuff, you can't even really crinkle that up. Anyway,
it doesn't have a lot of friction. It's still better than a corn cob, I guess, is our moral for today. That's our takeaway. Better than a corn cob.
Ben, I don't know if it's just me and where my mind is right now, but I heard that as corn cob. We're all a little loopy. But I will tell you, Ben, and we're not being sponsored by them, but we were in the past, really happy we got our tushy bidets back when we did, because there was a period where I could not find toilet paper and I ran out entirely. And with the tushy bidet, you just need one little square, just a little dab, you know, and then you're clean as a whistle. So highly recommend you guys get one. It's a great way to conserve your toilet paper and stay fresh and clean, even during quarantine times.
Yep. You can also get on the mailing list for the IKEA catalog if you're not too proud in the restroom. But, you know, this episode is a little on the shorter side, but it's such an interesting story and it touches on so many things we're going to explore in the future. We want to thank you for tuning in, Ridiculous Historians. We hope that this episode finds you well and finds you, you know, not in corn cob level desperation in the restroom. But yeah, we'd like to hear your stories of a strange strange spy arrangements. We'd like to hear your stories of the Sears catalog and other bits of odd Americana. You can find us on the internet. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram. All the hits, all the good ones except for a Pinterest page. So far.
You know, but what better time than the quarantines to really dig into that vision board that we once talked about every episode and then very conveniently never mentioned again until right now. But you know what, Ben? Maybe we should team up on a vision board. I'll do dolphins and unicorns and you can pick your motif and we'll come together and make something that we can all get behind.
Right on. I didn't know. I'm surprised to learn that about you. I didn't know you were a fan of dolphins and unicorns. Is it like all horse-like creatures or just specifically unicorns?
Well, I'm mainly into mythical creatures, so my dolphins also need to have some mystical quality to them as well. Don't really care for the real-world ones. More of a Lisa Frank dolphin kind of guy.
Okay, yeah, I can get behind that. Maybe throw a Selkie in the mix, keep things interesting.
I'm sorry, a what?
A Selkie? S-E-L-K-I-E? Okay, so it's this, we don't have time for this, but it's like a were-seal, basically. They could change it to a seal. They could go on land. It's a whole thing. It's worth, you know what? It's worth a read. There's some pretty cool Selkie stories out there. I'm inspired. I'll try to find something as well. You know, what should we put in our vision board? That's a good one. Tell us over at Ridiculous Historians on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you. You can also find us not just as a show, but as individuals here on the old internets.
It's true. You can find me in my quarantine adventures, which lately have involved a pink and green haired child and things like making tie-dye shirts and homemade lip balm. Yeah, I know. You really got to get creative during these times. You can find me on Instagram exclusively at HowNowNoelBrown.
And you can find me on Twitter at BenBolinHSW or at BenBolin on Instagram. I'm getting into some weird things. I think by the time I get out of here, I'm going to have a Old Testament level beard. I forgot how quickly it grows and how red it is. If it's so red that even I can tell it's red, that thing's like a fire engine on my face. So check it out before I shave it.
Well, it looks ravishing, Ben. I'm a fan.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much. And thanks, as always, of course, to Alex Williams. I'd like to also, Noel, if you're cool with us mentioning this, I'd like to give a special thanks to our good IRL real life pal, Ryan Lambert, who sent us a pretty neat surprise earlier.
He did, not for this show, but for our show, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Ryan did a kind of a reimagining of that theme, which we've had for many, many, many years back as far as the YouTube days. And we're toying around the idea of at least letting folks hear it. And who knows what could happen? All bets are off these days. But yeah, big thanks to Ryan. He actually sent me an updated version of it today that I'll send to you. Added in a little part and adjusted some mix stuff. So yeah, thanks a lot, Ryan. Always thanks to super producer Casey Pegram. Thanks to Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit, Gabe Luzier, our research associate extraordinaire, who we are promising and will honor that promise to have on the show very soon.
Yeah, and also thanks to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister. I was talking with him a little bit yesterday. He says hello to everyone, and he will, of course, return at some point with a scenario. So stay tuned for that. And of course, as always, Noel, thanks to you, man. Thanks for hanging out.
Oh, man. It's been a pleasure. See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.